Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we are here with a real interesting player and a very talented writer, performer, and scorer. We're with Doug Womble. Doug was originally born in Memphis, where he listened to his mom play piano in their Baptist church and his granddad singing cowboy songs and old-time gospel favorites while strumming the guitar. And as a result, Doug's been pretty much immersed in music for his entire life. As I'm reading this, Doug, I'm like, things you'll never hear somebody who comes from the Bronx say. I was listening to my grandfather singing cowboy songs. Sorry, man. It was just really funny.
I love that.
After completing two music degrees, Doug decided to head over to New York City to seek a career as a guitarist and a composer, appearing on bandstands and recordings with such artists as Wynton Marsalis, Norah Jones, Stephen Bernstein, Courtney Love, Madeline Peru, and Cassandra Wilson. Doug was making a name for himself in the jazz world when he was signed to Branford Marsalis' label, Marsalis Music / Rounder Records. I guess it's a division of Rounder. Doug released two critically acclaimed records, Country Libations and Blue State, and then decided a change was in order. He shifted from being a hardcore jazz player to a singer-songwriter. In 2009, he released a self-titled album and followed up in 2013 with another singer-songwriter album on his own record label called Fast as Years, Slow as Days, great title, which was funded by a wildly successful Pledge Music Drive. That is, you know what? Now that I'm taking a second look, that is a really good title. I just want to interrupt. How did you come up with that, man? Because that's pretty profound.
I wrote this song that's on that record. It's called Master Plan. And when I was writing it, it was kind of in a very strange transitional time in my life. My first marriage was coming to an end. My son was, at the time, I think he was like 5 or 6 years old. And, you have these moments of reflection with your children where the time goes so fast. But when you go day to day, the days can sometimes seem to go on forever, you know. And I wrote this song that, I was kind of thinking about time and life changes, and it was, cast yourself into the water, past the seas of old man waves, last and least your sons and daughters, fast as years, slow as days.
Wow, man, I got goosebumps when you said that. That's intense, man. Real good stuff. And hey, you got to have at least one divorce, Doug. It's just you're not complete.
Hey, man. Hey, you know? Listen. It's just
a practice marriage. That's how you got to look at it. In 2014 came Doug's first all instrumental recording. Another cool title, Redneck-tellectual, which features his original compositions all performed on a single guitar using non-traditional recording techniques and treating the resophonic guitar like a bass, a drum, and a piano all at once. Now I know why you're friends with Charlie Hunter. Building on his history at Wynton Marsalis, which led to guitar contributions to several Ken Burns documentaries for PBS, such as Prohibition and Unforgivable Blackness, Doug then began working as a composer for Burns' Florentine Films, collaborating with Ken, his daughter Sarah, and David McMahon for the tragic film The Central Park Five, as well as the Vietnam and Jackie Robinson documentaries. I'm going to take a quick pause here and tell everybody that I was in New York City growing up as a kid when that whole shit went down, the Central Park Five. And watching the documentary was fucking eye-opening. It was so, not to get off the subject matter, but it's a very intense documentary. So check it out. It's called The Central Park Five. If you haven't seen it. As are all of Ken Burns' documentaries. Doug also co-wrote and produced epic recording artist Morgan James on her first album called Hunter, and he's touring with her now, and we'll have a talk about that later. Doug's got a full plate ahead of him for this year and upcoming. He's touring with Morgan James in the U.S., as I mentioned. He's premiering a new composition by Wynton Marsalis for jazz at Lincoln Center, where he's actually a featured guitarist and vocalist, and he's also got more film projects under his belt. Doug, thanks so much. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, man.
Oh, pleasure is all mine.
And you live in Harlem.
I do. You said you're from the Bronx, right?
I am. You haven't lived. What's that?
We're in the Bronx.
Man, I grew up on Jerome Avenue and 183rd Street. So,
that's kind of well. That's actually my first wife and I, who are actually still very, very close, and we have a wonderful 13-year-old son. He lives with my wife Morgan and I here half the time, but the other half the time he lives in this place that we moved to in 2007 at the corner of 167th and Anderson.
I know exactly where that is, man.
Yep.
That whole area is much nicer today, I think, than it was like when I was a kid. I know it's cleaning up. And the concourse, I can't believe how it's gentrifying, man.
We've been looking at apartments up there. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, and I love it. I love it so much up there. So.
Yeah. You can get big apartments up there too, because those old pre-war buildings were massive.
Yeah.
Well, hey, you finished two music degrees down south, I think, right? And then you
One in Florida, and then I went to my grad school in Northwestern, up in Chicago area.
Okay. And then you moved to New York. That's a really big move. And then you're here now still. Obviously, you loved it. What was behind that decision, and like, what did you do music-wise when you first got there to pick up gigs and to start getting network? Because it's not an easy place to break in, as you know.
Well, I started laying the groundwork early. I mean, I didn't grow up playing the guitar really. I mean, I knew a couple of chords, but I was a clarinet player in the band, and I loved guitar music, and I loved, you know, all the stuff that, you know, every teenage kid from the 80s likes. You know, I liked Van Halen and Eric Clapton, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and the Stones, which really led me into getting into Muddy Waters, which led me into Robert Johnson and Albert King and all that blues stuff. So I was always really attracted to the guitar. And when I started college, I went to school in Memphis for a couple of years, and I had a free scholarship just for academic stuff. So I was like, you know what, I'm gonna focus on music. And so I started, you know, I knew G, C, and D. That was about it. But I got really into jazz. I mean, that's kind of when I heard Charlie Christian. I was, like I said, I was a clarinet player. I heard a Benny Goodman record with the great electric jazz guitarist, Charlie Christian. And I was like, man, that to me, he sounded like Albert King and T-Bone Walker, but like with some extra shit on it. I was like, what's that? Like, because it still had that feeling, you know, it was like just grooving and funky, but it had all this other information that was really it fascinated me. So I started getting deeper and deeper into jazz, and wound up transferring to the University of North Florida in Jacksonville, which had a great jazz department. And when I was down there, I got to know a lot of musicians that were kind of affiliated with Winton. And then I also met Cassandra Wilson, the great singer. She was one of our guest artists at our college jazz program thing. So I really hit it off with her, and she was, this was like 92, 93 or something. And she said, listen, you should come to New York, you know, whenever you're ready, come to New York. We're going to work together. I like your vibe. It's really cool. And I mean, she was at that time, she had just done this great record, her first record for Blue Note. And we found out we were both Chris Whitley fans, because Chris Whitley had played on her record and all this kind of stuff. So I was really fascinated by her, and like crazy in love with her too. So I was just like a 19-year-old chubby dork. In fact, there's a YouTube video I think I put up of one of those concerts of us playing together on that concert in the early 90s. And I'm just gazing at her. It's amazing. But I got really into Wenton's music and the way that he wrote for small groups, especially his septet at the time. And so when he came to Jacksonville for a jazz festival, I met him, and I was super nervous. It was like, I was more nervous talking to him than I was like rolling up to a supermodel, you know. I was just terrified, but he was real cool. He gave me his address, and I sent him some music that I wrote for my senior recital. And, you know, I sent him a cassette tape, and then like, I moved to Chicago in 95, I guess it was. And I took a year off in between undergrad and graduate school. But one day, I remember I was setting up my apartment in Chicago. This is maybe 6 months or so after I sent this tape to Wenton, and I get a phone call, and it's Wenton. And he was calling me from the road saying it's that he had just heard my music, and he was like blown away by my composing. And he was like, keep in touch, you know, you got to come to New York. And so when he came through Chicago, a couple of years later, and we hung out, and he was like, you know, when you get to New York, it's inevitable that we're going to hook up and work together. So I set goals. I think that's something that I've been teaching for 2 years now because of Wynton at the Juilliard Jazz Program. And that's what I tell my students. I was like, it's not enough for you to just want to be a good player. But you have to have specific goals. You have to say, what do you want to do in 10 years? Where do you want to be? And you're not always going to end up there, but it's the process of working towards a goal that gets you on your path.
Definitely.
And so that's what I did. I mean, I wanted to work with Wynton Cassandra. When I moved to New York City, the first day in town, I went to see Wynton. He was rehearsing at Lincoln Center with his band. I ran into my friend from college, Marcus Printup, who plays trumpet in that band still to this day. He said, hey, my friend Madeline Peyrou has a tour. She needs a guitar player for her. So the first day I'm in New York,
I auditioned
for Madeline's gig. It was a North American tour on a bus and everything, opening up for Sarah McLachlan.
Oh, wow.
So I'm thinking, man, New York City, I got this, bitches. What's struggle, you know? I had a gig day two, you know? The lean time set in shortly thereafter. But still, I started off well. And then within the first year of being in New York, I had that tour. I did my first record date with Cassandra. I did my first recording with Wynton. So things were really going well. And, you know, the problem is that I kind of didn't set my goals high enough, because I was just like, man, I achieved everything I set out to do very, very quickly. And then I had to kind of reassess, you know. So that's kind of my path to New York kind of goes through Wynton and Cassandra, you know. And you know, I haven't worked with or seen Cassandra in ages, but she was a wonderful inspiration. And I think the last time I saw her was at backstage at a Prince concert, where she picked up Prince's guitar, his famous Telly, and she was like, I can't play this thing. Here, Doug, why don't you play it? So I got to jam with Prince on his guitar.
Holy
which was
crap.
Pretty freaking cool.
So
thanks, Cassandra.
So, wow, this is like a surreal, you know, this is a one in a, you know, 100, 150 story. When you looking back to piggyback on something you said, what do you think you could have done during that process to either keep the ball rolling, or so that when the lean times didn't come, or when they came, you had other stuff going on, you know, in hindsight, 2020, of course.
My hindsight is probably from a few years later, because my career went pretty great. You know, I mean, when I say lean times, you know, you don't get a lot of kids moving to New York for anymore because they can't afford it. You know,
yeah.
My rent was, well, when I lived on 122nd Amsterdam with two roommates in 97, my rent was $300 a month.
Okay.
And there were many months where my only gig was, I kind of inherited this three nights a week gig at 53rd and 7th, and it paid $50 a head. So it was for a trio, paid $150. So I lived basically on $150 a week, $600 a month for quite a while.
So half of that went to your rent, and then
half that was rent, and you had bills, and then lots of, you know, ramen and discounted eggs. But it's, you know, I think that I rode that wave into playing on other people's records, getting some gigs, writing, and then when I had a couple of you know, some near misses with some record labels, like Atlantic Records was interested. I had a demo deal with Blue Note. They both passed. And so then I parlayed that right into, like, you know, I'm a pretty decent networker. I suppose I like to meet people and talk to people. And so Branford was an idol of mine ever since I was, even before I was a jazz musician, I thought when I saw that Sting documentary of Bring on the Night, I thought Branford was just the coolest dude ever, you know. So I became friends with him, and I talked to him a little bit about the industry, and he had just left Columbia Records because he was with them for a long time as an A&R as well as an artist. So he said, "Hey man, why don't you send me some music? And if you suck, I'll say you suck."
Right.
You know, because he's just that blunt. So I sent him some music, and I got signed, and I did some great records and did a lot of touring, and this is all really wonderful. But where my hindsight question comes in is here. At that point is when I took my eye off the ball into thinking that I was on my path and that I would just keep making the kind of records that I wanted to make for as long as I wanted to and be on the road with my band as long as I wanted to. Because that's what I was doing for a few years, touring the world with my own group, playing my favorite stuff. We played like acoustic jazz beats, like kind of avant-garde beats, Delta blues meets gospel and all this kind of stuff. So I moved, my first wife and I moved out to Connecticut, and she is a classical singer as well as a voice professor. So I took some time back a little bit when my son was born, and I kind of slowed my career down. And I think that that's where I kind of went off track is number one, leaving the city, because then people, if you're not up in people's grill all the time, they just forget about you.
Yeah, for sure. Out of sight, out of mind.
Out of sight, out of mind. So I didn't stay focused in that realm. I got a little bit too arrogant thinking that I was Branford because I was associated with him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a bold admission.
I didn't think that I was as good as him or anything like that, but I thought that my path was going to be like that. And so I kind of, and then musically too, I was like trying to always write music that was about getting the band to be better and all these things, which is all, these are great things. But I should have, in hindsight, I should have kept doing what I'm supposed to be. I'm not supposed to be Kurt Rosenwinkel.
Right.
That's not my path, you know? And I didn't want to be him per se, but I wanted to be me, but have his worshipers. You know, I wanted to be the jazz guitar guy that moved to New York, made everyone stand up and be like, "Oh man, womble, womble, womble." And that shit just didn't happen. That wasn't my path. So I took my eye off the ball a little bit, and then it necessitated me reevaluating my path. So instead of being a jazz musician, now all of a sudden I'm stuck in Connecticut. I'm basically a full-time dad, which was, I mean, talk about a payoff. My kid's 13 now. I don't regret a day of that.
Sure.
We're as close can be, and I love that time. Out of that time, though, I bought a Mac. I got software I want to be a film composer. So I started learning how to use a computer, which led me into producing people's records, which led me into, well, I'm spending more time at home, not dealing with being a band leader on the road playing jazz. Well, now I'm starting to write songs. And so all these things, it's, you know, it was a strange left turn for someone who's just wanted to play jazz. But then all of a sudden, I'm finding these new things that I really, really enjoy. And I bring something to the table as a producer or songwriter that a lot of producer and songwriters don't have because of my jazz background, because of the music that I've been exposed to. So, you know, in hindsight, I definitely see where I could have changed my path in terms of, I mean, we all look back and like, man, what could I have done to keep my first marriage?
Of course, of course.
What could I have done to change my career? But what did happen is that I made some decisions that put me where I am today. For sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate you sharing that. And I think it's, I think everybody, like you said, doesn't, there's not a person that gets away without, you know, looking back and saying, woulda, coulda, shoulda, you know, that's called tuition. What, okay. So What prompted the singer-songwriter thing? Was it just starting to use the software more and seeing that you wanted to do more stuff of your own, as opposed to, or was it just a natural evolution of, hey, I'm not out touring now. Let me try something else that's more congruent with that.
I think it was really just about kind of connecting a different part of my personality. I mean, you know, it's not like I'm one of these people that are, I've never been one of those people that just listen to jazz. You know what I mean? I've always listened to all kinds of music and studied, you know, I mean, I've gone way deep diving on, you know, the Band and Hank Williams and bluegrass and, you know, all sorts of stuff. So and gospel music, Sister Rosetta Tharpe and all that. But I've always been a huge fan of singer-songwriters, you know, and I've always played with them just as a side man, you know. And I love the immediacy that you get from connecting with someone with a song. There's something. Remember seeing this documentary years ago. I actually think it was Behind the Music by the Black Crowes, and Chris Robinson said, "Man, we're all just trying to be part of the big song. We're all just trying to write our little piece of it." I remember at the time thinking, "This guy's full of shit. Oh my God, what a." But over time, I'm kind of like on board with that, because if you can, you know, if you can write a song that makes that touches someone, that there's something about that that's more. It's just it's got a timelessness that a jazz solo doesn't. You know, for most people, not everyone is going to be moved by Lester Young or Louis Armstrong. I am, and many many people are. But how many people, you know, over the years have heard, Yesterday, or have heard any number of great songs that we love, you know, and just, you know, I remember being a 13-year-old kid and I heard Going to California on a Big Jet Plane, and I was like, oh. That, yeah, it touched something. I was just like, oh, I love that, you know?
Yeah, it's a much bigger swath of the population that can connect with a singer-songwriter than with right. a jazzer. That's just the reality
of it. Of course, it's just the reality of it. So it's not that I was consciously thinking of that, but I was just like, I really want to try to write some songs and also learn how to, like, just because I can play like a bajillion chords and time signatures and all that jive bullshit, what can I do if I just try to write simply, you know? Yeah. But I of course like people who are great musicians who are songwriters. I mean, Jeff Buckley was a great musician. Chris Whitley was a great musician. So I think just listening to them, I love. He lost me on the Grateful Dead path that he's on, but like John Mayer is a great guitar player and singer songwriter. I love.
It's so funny, man. A lot of people get lost on the Grateful Dead path, man. It's hard. It's definitely a, like I've never.
I've tried listening. It's just, it is not for me.
No, I know. I have a shit ton of Dead music, and I really love, you know, like in doses once in a while, you know, and right. they're not frequent doses, to be honest.
Yeah.
Be honest with you. I know what you're saying, man. It's just a different vibe.
Yeah, it's just a little. It's so white. I can't. It's painfully white, man. I'd rather listen to Pat. I think Pat Boone's a little more funky. But
I don't know about that. But I feel you.
Anyway, I started writing some songs, and I think also like just there's something about writing a song when you're in a spot. I mean, I wrote all of these songs that wound up on those two singer-songwriter records. And, you know, it's so many of them are just like love letters. They're just like trying to keep my home together, you know?
Sure.
Trying to write a song and show someone through a song that that you love them, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, so that kind of started me there. And then I'm one of my good buddies, Adam Levy, who's a wonderful guitar player, plays with Nora Jones.
No, I know Adam.
People, he started this thing called the Song Club several years ago, and basically he would send out an email to a bunch of his contacts with a title, and then everyone would upload every week to like a Dropbox, and we would all see what each other came up with.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Really, he doesn't do it anymore, but
it's a lot of time.
This 1 year, again, I mean, I'm not the first person or the last that's going to have their lives affected by, you know, have their songwriting affected by their lives.
Sure.
But I went through this when I went through my divorce. I got, you know, I made the always, you know, stupid decision to like get involved with someone who was also on a rebound. And, you know, I was just like trying to grab onto something. You know?
Sure, so this man. Girl, totally normal
girl destroyed me. Good thing that comes out of this though, is that it was in this year where Adam was doing the song club and I did it every year. So, I mean, every week. So I wrote 52 songs.
Oh, you know, that's good shit, man.
Now, some of them were absolute crap. I mean, I'll be the first to admit, but I did get a lot of good songs out of that. And
but you're going to write absolute crap some songs, whether it takes you 52 songs in 52 weeks or 52 songs in 4 years. You're going to have, just statistically, you're going to write some good ones and some shitty ones.
You have to write the shit out of you, too. You know, it's like you know, toxins out of your liver.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just, you know, I sort of started on that, and it's, and then as that period of time came to a close, I'm starting to write more, and that's when I, you know, I meet Morgan James, my wife. She hires me to be a guitar player on a somewhat jazz oriented project of Nina Simone tunes.
Oh, I love Nina.
Yeah, and so we did a couple of gigs, and after the gig, I said, you know, you ever write? She's like, well, not really. She's like, she's just like a killer singer. You know, she's been in several Broadway shows and she's like a dynamic soul singer. And I was like, well, we should get together and write, you know? So we wind up, I give her a bunch of songs. She used one of my songs that I had written from the song club, actually, that became the title track from her first album on Epic Records. You know, and we started writing together. We fell in love. Now we're married, blah, blah, blah. But
there you go, yeah, man.
Songwriting definitely, that path allowed me. I've always used music as a means of healing, as everybody does. It's the place you can go to that, you know, lets you get stuff out of you. But when you can write a song and try to, my goal has never been to write songs about me, but use my experience to make someone feel like that song's about them.
Yeah, I get it. It's funny that I was stuck on what you said to use songs. You use a song as healing, and it's just, I was talking to somebody yesterday how amazing music is. Where, you know, I'll hear something and I'm not even feeling bad. I'm feeling good, but it just takes, you know, it's like taking you feeling good and it freaking hits you with a cattle prod and amplifies those good vibes that you might be having, and it's just like, you know, it takes you to a place where you didn't even know you can go or be for that next 3.5 to 5.5 minutes, you know, and it's just such a wonderful, it's just a wonderful experience, man. It really is unlike anything. So have you now, again, looking back, do you think you've had more growth as a musician from the singer songwriter stuff or from the jazz stuff? And you plan on staying in the singer songwriter genre moving forward?
Well, I mean, I'm in a very different phase of my life right now. You know, I'm not pursuing any sort of solo career at this point.
Right.
You know, that's not really where I'm at. I'm kind of enjoying what I do, which, you know, I love this, working with these students at Juilliard. It's amazing. And then I've got a couple of, you know, steady New York City gigs around town that I play when I'm not touring. And then the rest of the time, you know, I'm working with my wife on our records and on her records, producing them, and then, you know, being the musical director on the road, and then somewhere in there finding time to produce other people's records and do film score. And that's just, you know, and I think that being a producer, for instance, it's like, I couldn't have done that if I had just stayed on the jazz path.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't really see it as an either or anymore. Now I'm kind of I still practice because I just, that's just part of my day. I want to practice because I don't have like that natural, I'm always in some of my friends, like, well, Charlie Hunt's a great example. He practices all the time, but he never plays guitar with a pick, right?
Yeah.
But then if he picks up a guitar with a pick, he can blaze faster than me. I can't do that. I just don't have that, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to really stay on top of my chops all the time to keep up to the level that I want to be at. But I'm also kind of like, I'm not trying to be anything anymore other than just, I do what I do. And it's not for everybody. You know, I get people that call me for things and I'm just like, bro, I respect you. I don't think I'm the guy for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you want someone that plays this way, call them.
Yeah.
That ain't me, you know?
Well, it sounds like you're in a good place now, which is a real nice place to be, and you're enjoying it, which is a real nice thing to do. So fucking rock on, man. Good for you.
Yeah, man. I couldn't be happier.
Hey, I'm going to throw out a couple of names of people you've worked with. And if you could talk about how you got the gig and maybe an interesting or cool story about working with them. And
yes,
you talked about how you got the gig working with Wynton. And I'm like amazed at how that all came together. That's so freaking cool. And kudos to you, though. I think where the default would have been for a lot of people is, hey, send me your tape. And that's where people would fall off.
Yeah.
You know, and I see that time and time again over my life in business. But any cool or interesting stories about working with Wynton?
And, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, he premiered, it's the 30th anniversary of Jazz and Lincoln Center. And Wynton's written many long form compositions in his day. He wrote one back. The concert that I saw in 97 when I was living in Chicago was called Blood on the Fields. He won a Pulitzer for that. It's a 3-hour long piece featuring Cassandra Wilson, actually, but it's all about slavery. So, you know, we did a gig together a couple of months ago. It was a gala benefit thing for Brooks Brothers. It's really fun, actually. It was Wynton's band. I was playing with him, and we got to play with Alison Krauss, who I really love.
That's cool.
Mark O'Connor, and it was really cool. And Wynton was telling me about this piece that he was, you know, I'd been hired to do this concert, but I had no idea what the music was. And it was an original thing of his called the Ever Funky Lowdown. And it's just a couple of hours of music. And it was
just a couple of hours of music. That's quite funny.
it's 2-hour long piece. And, you know, and it just deals with the culture as it stands today. He deals with a lot of very poignant issues. And he had three wonderful vocalists, three dancers, this great actor from The Wire and Tremé, Wendell Pierce, was a narrator. But I sort of was featured as the guitarist and singer. And it was the thing when he hired me to just do what I do. And, you know, as someone who's been, you know, it's different when you're 22 and you meet Wynton Marsalis and you're nervous and you're trying to be cool. Or I'm speaking of, for me, I was trying to be cool, trying to be accepted, you know, and very insecure. And now, you know, as a 45-year-old man, he's just my, you know, he's still a mentor to me, but now we can interact as fathers and adults. And I'm not really trying to, I mean, I always want to do well because his music requires it, but it was really just, it was such an honor to be there. We did three nights at Lincoln Center. I think one of the performances is on YouTube. It's really fun to work with someone that you've been respected, that you've been respecting and loving their music for, you know, 25, 30 years. And to have him say, well, I wrote this piece with you in mind. There's only one guy who could do this. It's got to be you.
That's
and
really
it wasn't,
cool.
And it wasn't all like jazz guitar shit. There was some of that. But a lot of it was like, can you do that thing where you play slide and sing along with it? Yeah. And then some of it was just like Lead Belly type. I was singing a folk song. And some of it was more like Robert Johnson. But like he wrote it for me. And that was, you know. I always, in those moments when wonderful things are happening, we often don't appreciate them. We often don't sit in the moment.
Yeah.
And I do this all the time with my kid. I'm like, we get to the end of a good day and I'm like, Charles, hey man, let's just take a moment. Let's take a moment and think how great this day has been. Let's just not think about anything else, but focus on how great this moment is. And I really did that with Wynton, and I tried to also, you know, kind of look back and just be like, man, just imagine that 21-year-old kid who met Wynton, and imagine how he'd be feeling if he knew this was in his future. You know,
yeah,
I like taking that time to just kind of, you know, sort of exist in the moment. You know.
Yeah, and it sounds like that was a good opportunity for you to measure, or not measure, but to appreciate your kind of your own path, where you've been on, where you are now, and you know, see your own maturity as a musician and as a person in that same interaction with a guy that you had a totally different headset on, you know, 24 years ago. That's really cool, man. That's really good. This I was surprised. Courtney Love. What'd you do with Courtney? Yeah, that was like a check. Okay. Oh. Circle.
All right. Buckle up, because this is a story.
Wait a minute. Is there anything to do with Courtney Love that's not a story?
This may be my best story. My wife always makes fun of me. Like, she's like, "You're such a raconteur. You like cross your leg and fold your arms." I'm like, this is legs crossed, arms folded.
Let's do it, bro.
In the summer of 2001, so the summer before 9/11, mm-hmm. Trumpeter Stephen Bernstein, who's one of my best friends and who I've worked with for many years, he took me on my first trip to Europe, and I love that guy. I played with him on Thursday. You know, it's just he's one of my boys. He calls me up, and he works a lot with Hal Willner. So Hal Willner he's been the music supervisor chief of SNL since day one. And he's always got his fingers in all sorts of pies. He's always doing these cool concerts. Like, he did a Dylan tribute at Town Hall a couple of months ago. And, you know, he's just always involved in cool stuff. So Courtney Love was doing a fundraiser for a theater company at the Russian Tea Room. And she wanted a band to play some 1920s music, because she was trying to get this movie made about a speakeasy hostess named Texas Guinan from the 20s. And she was going to play the lead. So it was myself, Stephen Bernstein on trumpet, the bassist, John Zorn's bassist, Greg Cohen. And then on piano was Roddy Bottom. And Roddy Bottom was the piano player, keyboard player for a band I used to like when I was a kid called Faith No More.
Yeah, I knew that name. That's right. Yeah, very cool.
So he's an old friend of Courtney's. So we had like 4 days of rehearsal, and it was bizarre. It was Courtney. You know, she was lovely. I mean, she was very, very sweet, very gentle, like insane, but like really fun. And, you know, at the time, her boyfriend was her manager. They were, you know, it was a weird thing. And this is like, the technology was weird, because she had like the two-way pager. Remember those things?
Oh my God.
It was like proto-texting. And I remember she was like texting with her daughter and like Ed Norton and all these people, you know. It's very strange. So fast forward to, so we rehearsed. It was cool. You know, she took me to her loft down on Cross Street. Hanging out, you know, there was absolutely nothing like illicit, like drug wise or anything right. like that. She seemed to be completely, you know, straight and narrow the whole week. So we get to the Russian Tea Room for sound check. It's about noon, and we're running through stuff, and we're playing songs like California, Here I Come, but with Courtney Love. You know, right. it's bizarre. You know, and she was, you know, she was it was weird. So she said, "Well, listen, if you guys want to bring your wives or your girlfriends or whatever, we're going to have a little catered thing before the gig." So invite them down. So Jana, the mother of my son, my first wife, she and I had just been, we'd been living together for like just a couple of months by this point. We'd been together less than a year. And so I tell her, I was like, "Why don't you come down to the Russian tea room around 3 and we'll hang out and eat, and then you stay for the gig and all this kind of stuff." So we finish sound check, we go upstairs and we're hanging out. And we're in this giant like ballroom on the second floor of the Russian Tea.
That's like right off Central Park South or something, isn't it?
It's like right next door to Carnegie Hall.
Right. Okay. Yep. So 7th Avenue, like 50-something street.
Yeah, exactly. So, so in walks 1 p.m. in like a ball gown, Winona Ryder.
Okay.
So I'm about the perfect age for Winona Ryder. Like, I was a kid growing up watching Winona Ryder. You know, everybody in my generation had a Winona Ryder thing, you know. That's just the thing, you know. She was like this. She was like the original Scarlett Johansson, you know. So Winona Ryder walks in and with some dude, and she's a little loopy. Like, I wouldn't say, I mean, she was just a little loopy. She was just kind of bouncing around, you know. So then Courtney, who we hadn't seen for like 30 minutes, comes in, and Courtney is naked.
Wait a minute. She just walks in the Russian tea room naked.
We were upstairs where okay. there were like all yeah. rooms and stuff like that. And she was getting dressed and stuff. So she's naked.
Like literally naked?
Like literally not a stitch.
That's random.
So then she says, guys, we're making a change to the set. Winona, I want to sing. Winona and I are going to sing Johnny Cash's Long Black Veil. Doug, do you know it? It's like, of course. She's like, teach it to her. And she and so this and this whole time, like, and every time like anyone gets near Winona, Courtney's like whispering to them, you could probably, you know, have that tonight if you wanted. It wouldn't be that hard. So
bizarre, man.
It's so bizarre. So anyway, then Winona Ryder lies down on the floor and she's like, come here. And they, and Courtney was calling me Memphis Doug. She was like, oh, Memphis Doug, Memphis Doug. And, you know, the funnier part of the story, too, is like if you could have seen me in 2001, I was like 150 pounds heavier, which would just, it's just a mental image. You got to put that in the story. Really, really funny. So here's this fat dude on the ground next to Winona Ryder teaching her how to sing Long Black Veil.
I mean, she just, can't, hold on a minute.
Can't
just
sing.
Throw this out of curiosity. When people learn music, and I've never heard of this. I'm trying to be open. Is laying on the floor like a new way of learning music or something?
That's the Hollywood way, baby. That's how you do it in Hollywood.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to throw that out there because I thought it was a little weird.
It was about this time that my then girlfriend, now ex-wife, Jana walks in. So.
Yeah, that probably went down well.
Oh, she's cool. She was just like, this is crazy. And then Courtney comes in and sits down in front of us, cross-legged, still naked, while she gets her hair done. So, wow.
Did she know she was naked?
I don't know.
Yeah. You
know, it's very bizarre. So I'm laying down on the ground next to Winona Ryder, trying to get her to sing, she walks these hills in a long black veil.
Oh, my God.
While my sort of new girlfriend is sitting in a chair just spectating like this is the funniest she'd ever seen. Courtney Love is sitting in front of me. She's cross-legged in front of me. You do the math.
Yeah.
It was insane. And so that dynamic bops around for a little while. Then comes the gig. Now, we don't see Courtney for about an hour before the gig until she walks on stage. And in that hour, something happened. I don't know if she just got in a character, if she did some sort of subs, I don't know what it was, but she comes on stage and she had this beautiful, like, you know, couture gown that we saw earlier. And in the meantime, someone had ripped it apart with a razor blade. So it was, she was all like, it was crazy. The cast of Sex and the City was there. She was very belligerent with the audience. I mean, this is like the Russian tea room. We're talking about like
old. Oh, this is, yeah. Old
New York money.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Really upscale, so more money than sense kind of thing.
It wasn't going over well, you know. So then Winona gets up on stage and Daniel Lanois there, and we start singing this song, and Courtney starts yelling at me, Doug, you better turn your fucking reverb up. Lanois, turn his reverb up. And I'm
like, Daniel Lanois is not part of the performance, correct?
No, he's just in the So he comes over and starts cranking up my reverb knob. I'm like, thanks, bro.
Thanks, Daniel Lanois.
So we played the gig. The gig was just a total shit show, but oh fun. I mean, God. So afterwards, we're sort of standing around, and So the trumpeter, Stephen Bernstein, has a band called Sex Mob. So he has a Sex Mob t-shirt. He's like, Courtney, I wanted to give you the Sex Mob t-shirt. So she takes off her, this is after the crowd had gone. She takes off her dress to put on the Sex Mob t-shirt.
Of course.
And she's like, just sort of, I don't know if she's drunk or high. I don't know what's going on, but she's just like out, you know? So I'm just waiting to get my check, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking, have you guys gotten paid or?
They paid very, very well. It was awesome. But, So my girlfriend is standing there sort of waiting because we're going to get a cab. I got all my guitar and amps up with me and everything. So I was like, all right, Courtney, well, I'm gonna go. She's like, okay, come here. And then she kisses me like full on make out. Tongue in mouth. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I don't know where this mouth has been. Like, And then I sort of think, actually, I do. And so Jana was very, like, she was very collegial about the whole thing. And she said, well, just FYI, first thing you're doing when you get home is gargling with Clorox. So,
Wow.
So, yeah.
What?
And I kept in touch with her for a couple of years after that. We emailed and she called to check on me after 9/11. And
oh, that's nice.
She's a very sweet, sweet woman. I think she's had a weird time of it, but that was certainly one of the more memorable weeks of my life.
Wow. You know, I was thinking about coming on the, here naked, but I said, I shouldn't do that because maybe what if Courtney Love already did that and it'd just like be a waste of time.
Yeah,
you
waste of time.
You know? Holy shit. Wow.
Plus, I think that's Mark Maron's thing. He's always.
Holy shit. That is so funny, dude. Oh my God. I need like a second to process that whole thing. It's just so, well, you know what, man? Anytime like there's like drug quote behavior, there's always drama. And I'm like, so not into drama. And it's like to watch shit like that unfold is just like, it's just, you know, nothing's going to end right. There's going to be like just a series of bad decision making ongoing. And it's like drama, 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 man. It's wow.
I'm very lucky. I've been sort of like, I've never, even in being in New York in the 90s, all of my drug adjacent things were never, I never was really close to anyone who was deep into, you know, I know several drunks, but, you know, I only knew a couple of people that were kind of getting into the heroin thing. And
sure.
And then it's all my LA friends are always like, oh, you want to do some coke? I've never done coke. And I'm like, dude, have you like ever spent any time with me? Do I have any trouble like talking a million miles an hour? You don't want to see, you know, cocaine. I've never tried it, but I guarantee you it would be an experience for anyone that would enjoy it.
Yeah, but the people who do it aren't on regularly. They're not even thinking about the impact of it. It's just that's what they do, you know, to get through the day.
Well, to be fair, I did know one dude. I knew this one guy who was like motor mouth. Like he acted just like a ferret on a triple espresso all the time. And when he did coke, it chilled him out. So I don't know.
Wow, I'm going to write that down. That's a great analogy. Acted like a ferret on a triple espresso all the time. Touche, bro. That was good. What a story, man. You can't really top that. I want to just find out about Ken Burns, how you guys connected and any cool stories on that. And I don't expect, if you tell me Ken Burns was naked, man, this is my last show forever. Nobody's going to tell me anything better than that.
Yeah. No, I've never been naked with Ken Burns.
Officially, he's never been naked with Ken.
Ken, I met through working with Wynton. One very memorable story. Actually, great. This is a drug segue. This works out perfect.
Awesome.
There was a transit strike in New York City 12, 13, 14 years ago. And I was living in Connecticut at the time, and you couldn't get in the city via car unless you had four people. So they were restricting. You had to have carpools, had to have four people. And all we had, and we were actually, my wife at the time and I were having jokes about like the Dred Scott decision because we had a baby. And I was like, does he count as a person? Is he three-fifths? Sure. So Ken Burns sent one of his assistants out to Connecticut so we could all drive in together.
Oh, that's so cool.
I had just had an ACL replacement the day or two before, something like that. I was in excruciating pain, but I had this session for this film with Ken, and I did the entire session completely high on Vicodin.
Yeah.
And but I talked to Ken, and I told him, I said, you know, I really want to get into film composing. And he was like, oh, you should send me your reel. And I was like, great. And unlike with Winton, where I had some recordings, I was like, man, I don't have a reel. So I talked to a director friend of mine, and he's like, yeah, man, just get some movies that you like, get the DVD, rip the DVD to your computer, take out the music, and put your own score to it.
Wow, that's really good.
So I did that, and then I gave it to Ken. And, you know, within a few months, they called me in to work on a film. And I did a few little things. They sourced music from a lot of areas for some of the things. Like on the Vietnam movie we did was like, you know, 17 hours long. So much of this, I did a few cues. A lot of it was done by Trent Reznor and another composer. So, you know, that's kind of how they do things. But, you know, there's a thing that I do you know, a way that I play that really works for a lot of things in his film. So he just keeps calling me, and people on his team keep calling me. His partner, Lynn Novick, is a brilliant director, and just everyone over there is just, they're great. We have a great relationship. They value music very highly in their films, and it's a very collaborative experience working with them, which is wonderful. So,
But you started that whole thing, man. And I want to point this out to the listeners. When you said, hey, Ken, I'd really like to score films. If you hadn't have said that, none of this shit would have ever happened.
And you got to be willing to stick it out there, man. There's no other way.
He's not like reading your mind, no. You know, thinking, oh man, I wonder if Doug wants to score, you know. And it's, I this is so important because I talk with a lot of people. And it's no different, like in the business world, you know, people say, man, how did that happen? 9 times out of 10, no, probably 95 times out of 100, that person made it happen by sticking his neck out there. I'd like to do this. How do you do that? You know, hey, Winton, I'd like to play with you. I like what you're doing. Can we work together? You know, and
that's when people complain all the time about the people that get famous who are shitty and not talented. It's like, well, yeah, we can complain about that, but those people are the ones who are—they're letting their hustle make up for their lack of talent.
100%.
So you gotta have—you know—at the end of the day, you want someone who has both. I mean, I don't—it's not my favorite music in the world, but shit, man, Bruno Mars is a great musician, but he also got his hustle on, his showbiz game on, and he has maximized his talent and abilities to having a globally huge career.
Absolutely, you know? And you're making music that's going to be heard. If you're working directly for Ken, all your music is going to get heard. It's all going to get licensed. It's going to get played again and again. You might license it to someone else. So you've got tons of monetization opportunities here with something like this. And in today's day and age, and I talk about this all the time with guys, if you're not freaking doing plan B, C, and D along with whatever your plan A is, you're a fucking idiot. Because A is going to fall apart at some part. I don't care what kind of gig you have. And I've heard this from guys I've interviewed that are, you know, anywhere from 35 to 75. You know, the artist gets a girlfriend or a boyfriend and they change the boyfriend, or the partner says, hey, I think you should have different people. The new manager, I spoke to a guy the other day. He's played on 4 million selling records for an artist. They come in the studio for the fifth record. He changes the band. I'm like, what the hell did he do that for? He goes, beats the shit out of me. This happens all day long. Like, so, you know, if you don't have backups, you're going to be screwed, man. Totally.
Well, yeah, it's we don't live in a world anymore where everyone can, I mean, there's some people who are, you know, doing one thing and that's great, you know, but I think, you know, I was talking to someone the other day. I work for this company. I work with a company called The Loop Loft. And, it's, a wonderful company, thelooploft.com. And basically what they do is they sell loops of different musicians. Charlie Hunter has a lute pack. I've got several. He has a lot of incredible drummers that do it. And so, like, you can basically just get Matt Chamberlain or Joey Warnker, like, their loops of them actually recording in the studio playing, and you can import them into your audio interface. And music producers love this stuff. In particular, they love guitar stuff because most of these guys don't play an instrument, you know?
Sure.
So, you know, that package, like, I just had one come out today. It's like a country loop thing. So someone pays 40 bucks for this, you know, and there's people who are in the old mindset who are like, man, you're just giving it away. You're giving it away. And I was like,
well, if 100 people buy it,
I was like, well, but it's not giving it away, because 95% of the people who buy loops to go into their software are never going to hire a musician.
Right.
That's just not the world that we live in.
Right.
However, thousands of people have bought my loops, and every quarter I get a nice residual off of that.
Absolutely.
In addition, there's other people who say, man, Doug, they'll email me through my website, I bought your loop pack, it's so great, I want you to play a custom one on my track. And then they'll hire me remotely to do that. So, you know, it's just like all of it works together. It's like I can't afford to just be like, man, I am just a jazz guitar player. Let me tell you, if you want to make $1 million playing jazz, you start with $2 million.
Yeah.
So,
right.
You know?
No, totally, man. Totally. Yeah. And all of this stuff, you have to look at it as lead generation, meaning anything you put out there is an opportunity to lead generate other pieces of business, like someone did for you. Say, hey, I like this. Do you want to do some tracks for me? You know, and who knows where that'll lead on to, you know, you've got to be out there, man. You've got to be hustling. 100% right, Doug. I want to ask you, you know, I talked earlier about the Central Park 5 documentary. Did you get any sense of how intense that was when you were making the score, or were you really apart from the actual documentary itself?
No, I was involved with, you know, I saw one of the early cuts of the film, and I had maybe heard of the story.
Yeah.
You know, growing up in Memphis in the 70s and 80s was pretty, you know, still pretty segregated for the most part.
Mm.
I remember the conversations that were had around the LA riots.
Sure. Rodney King, I remember that.
Yeah, OJ.
Mm-hmm.
All these conversations that were had where I come from were very, very different than the conversations that I get to be privy to as a resident of Harlem.
Sure.
After you know Trayvon Martin or after Michael Brown or Eric Garner, these things that happened, I wasn't aware. You know, I'm from a generation and a race where your parents tell you, "Hey, listen, if anything goes wrong, you call a cop."
Mm.
And so I didn't understand that there were people who raise their kids and say, "Hey, listen, if something goes wrong, look out for the police because things can go wrong."
Yeah,
there's a whole protocol about the way a young black man has to talk to his son. And so when I saw what happened with the Central Park Five and then watching it all sort of unfold, it was like watching it for the first time for me.
Yeah.
And seeing the story and that was in 2011. The movie came out in 2012. And I mean, just the things that have happened in our country since then, it's harrowing to think about what you can get away with in America if your victim is not white.
Mm.
And,
yeah, yeah.
What can happen to you as an innocent man if your victim is white in the case of the Central Park jogger. So it had a profound effect on me. It really did. But my whole journey on race has been one of the defining aspects of my life. I mean, just growing up, in a time and a place where, you know, we were taught a lot of things that were just wrong. And I'm not, I can't be blamed for how I was raised, but I can be blamed for not fixing it and not doing better with my son.
Sure, of course.
And films like the Central Park Five are just continuing educations for people like me and to, I think, for all white Americans, especially, like, we need to just listen more. We got to listen more. We can't always be a part of every conversation. We have to just sit back and listen. And I think that the work that needs to be done on some of these issues has to happen. It has to happen for me talking to my racist uncle. You know, like, that's because he can't hear it coming from Barack Obama. He can't listen to Barack Obama and not be filled with hatred and disdain.
Right.
But even though he and I disagree, he does love me and I do love him. I think his views on the world are horrifying and he thinks the same about me. But we can at least, that's where the work can be done, is within our own community. And otherwise, we have to just listen to people whose experiences we can never understand. I can never understand what it would be like to have cops haul me in and accuse me of doing something I didn't do and have no hope. Mm. That's just not something that happens to white dudes, you know? So I love the way that Ken and his entire world of filmmaking with his daughter, his co-producers, his co-directors, all these people, they keep the focus, that there's always a through line in every one of their films about what is at the heart of our nation, which is that we were built by doing two things, kicking one group of people off and building a country on the backs of slaves. That is still defining part of our culture. That's part of the reason why Obama got elected. It's part of the reason why Trump got elected. It's part of the reason why things, I mean, it is all so part of our national dialogue. It comes down to our original injustices, and we're still parsing those things out to this day. And it's non-linear, you know?
Yeah. Let me just give the listeners a little bit of context. So what I'm talking about is there's a documentary that Ken Burns made that Doug was involved in the scoring of. It was called The Central Park Five. And in a nutshell, what happened was in the, I believe it was the late 70s, mid to late 70s,
1989.
Oh, it was 89 when that happened?
Yep.
When the incident took place, it was 89?
Yep.
Wow, it seems so much longer ago. Wow. In 89, there was a young woman, which I guess in her late 20s, early 30s, jogging through Central Park, and she was brutally, brutally, savagely attacked. I mean, just beaten within inches of her death. Yeah. And she was in a coma, if I remember, for quite some time. And somehow something came about where the cops found a group of kids who said they were, quote, wilding, W-I-L-D-I-N-G. And that was like a new word at the time. And the problem was the manhunt to find out who did this was so intense, you know, because this was such a brutal act, and the cops under, it turns out, you know, they made like five arrests of these really young kids, but it turns out, as you've seen this documentary, those kids never did it. And they were sort of coerced into, they were coerced into confessing, and they were trapped into confessing. And, you know, I think if I remember correctly, they did get the real guys that did it. The real guys, they were in jail, I think, for something else or something, right? If I remember correctly.
Well, yeah, the murderer, Matias Reyes, was in prison. And one of the kids at the time that got arrested was 16. And so he went to Rikers.
Right.
He was also partially deaf and had severe learning disabilities. He should never have been at Rikers. He was in prison with the guy who was the actual murderer. Mm. And so it all unfolds, you know, where they get a confession from the guy who has matching DNA. Some people, you know, some of the people involved with that case, including you know, at the time, Donald Trump took out a huge one-page ad saying we should murder these kids or whatever. He still thinks that they did it. He says, well, they were collusion. There was collusion. They were colluding with the guy who actually did it. You know, so it was a very divisive thing, and it was in a time when New York City was, you know, you lived there, it was a rough place. It ain't like it is now.
Yeah, it's a lot nicer.
And so the city had they saw a brutally raped and assaulted white lady, and they wanted to find black kids to pin it on. It turns out that the guy who beat and raped her was not black, but they wanted that to be that was the narrative. And it was the Dinkins era, it was a little before Rudy Giuliani came in. They're probably part of why he got elected. You know, they wanted things to fit into that binary narrative of wild black kids. Black kids are dangerous. We have to be careful of them. They're coming for our women. It's the same shit we heard in the Reconstruction. You know, it's the same shit you heard. Keep your women away. Or, you know, keep your women away from the slave quarters. They're gonna, you know, these savages are coming for your women. Those narratives are still there today. You hear them at Trump rallies. Like, you know, lock her up. Beat him down. There's a black. You know, get him. We're afraid. We stay afraid. You know, that's what they're trying to do to us. And it's year after year, we don't learn our lessons.
Yeah, man. So if you haven't seen that movie, the Central Park 5 documentary, check it out. It was pretty intense. And if you grew up in New York and you haven't seen it, you definitely need to watch it because you'll remember all the media action that was going on there. You talk about growing up in Memphis. What was your childhood like?
I had a great childhood, you know, single mom. She just turned 70 years old.
That's awesome.
She worked three jobs. And so, you know, I saw my dad sometimes on the weekends, but spent a lot of time with my mom and my grandparents lived close by. So they helped raise me. And, you know, said we grew up in like a Southern Baptist church and very close to my mom's. I'm an only child. My dad has a daughter who's, I don't know, man, maybe she's like 30 now. I don't know. I've never met her. My mom's sister has three kids and her brother has one kid. So we all went on vacations together, hung out, spent a lot of time and family dinners on Saturday, lots and lots of laughter and love, just great, wonderful, loving family, you know,
great. You've mentioned your son a few times and it's, I would imagine you not growing up with a dad definitely weighed heavy and is one of the motivating factors for you making sure you're so close with your son and you do the things together and you get the time in.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I had a dad, I have a dad. We're not close, but, I think for me, I look back at a lot of the things that were rough about my childhood, you know, were partially because of that. And I think that, you know, my goal in life is to always find a way to accept what happens and then transcend it. And I think that the beauty of growing up with some of the challenges that I had with my father is that it gives me a wonderful template for exactly how I want to make changes as a parent. And, you know, I'm lucky that my grandfather is one who taught me how to play guitar. And he was just such a wonderful, wonderful man, just one of the greatest humans. And my uncles, you know, I love them very much. You know, one of them is like a Jehovah's Witness and the other one is from Mississippi. And none of us really agree on religion or politics or any of that stuff, but they were great. They are great fathers. And I learned so much from them, you know, I didn't grow up in New York City, so I get to be a parent to a New Yorker, which is, you know, I mean, I'm grateful. My kid is, he's not like a lot of New York kids. He's very gentle and sweet.
Yeah, that's not like a lot of New, you know, it's a rough place, man. Gentle and sweet aren't big adjectives there or you know, it's a tough place to grow up.
He's great, man. He's the, you know, center of my universe and I feel very lucky to get to be a part of his life. You know, he's taught me more than I'll ever teach him.
Is he getting ready to go to high school?
He is, he's 13, so he'll start eighth grade this year.
Okay. What high school will he be going to?
We're in the midst of it, man. Looking at it.
Trying to figure it out. Yeah, that's always a tough one, man. Well, good luck with all that. And congratulations for, not repeating the cycle, man. And for, being there for your son.
Yeah, man.
Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
What's your go-to guitar right now? You play a lot of cool guitars, man. What's your go-to right now? And maybe what other top two or three round out your top few?
Yes. My go-to right now, unfortunately, I don't have it with me. I'm going to go pick it up from the shop a little later. It's my newest guitar. A couple of years ago, I met a guy on Instagram. His name is Matt Eich, E-I-C-H, and he can be found at muleresophonics.com, like a mule, you know?
Yep.
Matt makes these incredible instruments that are just total game changers, man. There's never been a resonator like this thing. And he made me one. I got it a couple of months ago. And it's a brass tricone resonator guitar with a pickup, and it can do everything. I mean, I play straight ahead jazz gigs on it. It plays slide. It's like a combination of Wes Montgomery meets Sun House.
That's a great combo, man.
It's perfect for me. I think I fall somewhere in the middle there, you know? So I play that guitar all the time. It's one of the most beautifully made instruments that I've ever had. It's just, he's a real artist. He's up in Saginaw, Michigan.
Oh, wow.
One of the greatest guys you'll ever see. Just a sweetheart of a dude. He makes these incredible metal Telecasters, which are next on my list. Shh, don't tell my wife. You got to actually, if you go on his website, there's a really great story of he made a guitar for the guy that it was one of the main characters of Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole story that he has video documented about making a guitar for that guy. It's pretty cool.
Oh, that's cool.
But that's my go-to, man. I have been like playing that thing. I used it with Wynton Marsalis' gig. I use it on jazz trio gigs. I use it like playing with Hammond organ. I mean, it is just like the most versatile, badass guitar. And my other two main guitars that I took when I'm touring with my wife, I have a couple of custom guitars. I've been going to 30th Street Guitars in New York City for 20 years.
That are no longer on 30th Street.
It's now on 27th Street, yep. But Matt Brewster has been repairing my guitar since I've been in town, basically. And he's always just been so generous with me. He makes his own brand, which are called Rust. So I have, I bought a pair of 72 Telecaster wide range humbuckers. Those are my favorite pickups. And he built a semi hollow telly around that for me. And he made me a strap to match it.
There you go, man.
Yeah.
How could you have the telly without the strap?
You got to have them both, you know.
That's a pretty guitar, man. Let me see that again.
I'll show you the telly. So they're matching black and blue.
Yeah, you don't see that. That's really cool. So he's got
a chamber body, and then these pickups are just
blue. I've never seen a blue pickguard like that, man. It looks really cool. Jet black guitar with a dark. It's like a not navy.
It's like a royal. It's like a royal.
Yeah, like a royal blue with two humbuckers, man. That's really cool.
It's kind of a thing with me. I've got like
and your strats matching, isn't it? The same thing.
Strats matching, and then I've got like a blue sparkle amp, and yeah.
That's cool, man. Yeah. Hey, whatever your thing is, you know, you like it, fuck it, man. It's yours, you know. What the hell?
And then you know the other stuff is on the wall. You can.
Oh man, he's got a bunch of resonators and semi hollow. What is that jazz box up there?
That is a beautiful guitar that was made by. A guy named Dan Krugman, and that's a great story. That guitar is actually my engagement ring. When I asked my current wife Morgan to marry me, and my last wife,
All right, at 1:16:00 in this recording.
Yeah, exactly. I gave her a ring, and then she gave me this beautiful handmade arch top, and it's a beautiful guitar. Yeah,
that's awesome, man. Very cool. Congratulations. A beautiful guitar, man. Really cool looking. So you got some nice axes.
I do.
Who? Any players that influenced you that are out of the norm that people, you know, don't normally think of that are influenced on guys like you, jazz players?
A couple of guys. One guy was sort of a conceptual influence on me before I even heard him play. I used to read guitar magazines. Hmm. And I read an article about a guy named David Tronzo.
Yeah, man. I know who that guy is. He's a teacher at Berkeley, right?
Yes.
Dave, I just got referred to him. It's so funny.
Well, you know, I met him since then, and he's a wonderful guy. But, you know, when I was a kid, I was like reading about him, and I was like, wow, he plays slide jazz. That's cool. You know, when I started playing guitar, I got really into early jazz music. I was really into like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong and stuff and Sidney Bechet and some of the sound and the techniques of that period. I was like, man, I should, because I didn't really play it in open tunings at the time. I was just playing in standard. So I'd be learning like a Sidney Bechet solo or something. And I was like, man, I should try this on slide. Right. David Tronzo did that. Now, I didn't know what David Tronzo's music sounded like, but I knew, but he was like a conceptual influence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when I got really into Ornette Coleman and sort of the more avant-garde music, I started doing a lot more of that on slide. And then I moved to New York and you could find David Tronzo records. And I was like checking him out. I realized that I came to a lot of the same musical conclusions as he did. And I found that we had a lot of things in common as players. And then he, you know, was far more advanced than I. So I started really, really listening to him to check him out. And another guy who I really love is a guy named Kevin Bright. Bright. He's from Toronto. And he played... played with a lot of people, played with Katie Lang. I heard him on Cassandra Wilson's records, and then he did a record about 20 years ago with this incredible Brazilian percussionist named Ciro Baptista. And they did one record for Blue Note, and they had a two-man band. It was called Super Generous.
That's a cool name.
Check that record out, man. It's so heavy. Kevin just is a great slide player. He played with Nora Jones as well. Actually, I think for a while it was Kevin and Adam were her guitar players. And just,
man, she's had some great guitar players. I've interviewed some freaking amazing guitar players that have played with her.
Robbie McIntosh, you know, Smokey Hormel, Adam,
Jim Campolongo.
Yeah, man.
I just spoke with Smokey yesterday. It's really funny that you mentioned his name.
Cool.
He's a great guy, man. Really good experience.
He's a character.
He is a character. In the best way possible.
I love those guys. I love, you know, some of the other guys that people don't know a lot about are guys like Bernard Addison, who played with Louis Armstrong. Another guy named Lawrence Lucy. I had the opportunity to meet Lawrence about 10, 12 years ago. I think he lived to be 101. I met him when he was just on the verge of his 100th birthday. He was the last living member of Jelly Roll Morton's band.
Wow.
And he was a guitarist, and he was the best man at Louis Armstrong's wedding. And these guys played in that early jazz style that people often associate with Django, but they played more blues-based.
Yeah.
So I was really into that stuff, really into Lonnie Johnson. He made some records with Duke Ellington. And that kind of era of playing the early jazz stuff and the acoustic jazz players, I really got into that. Like, you know, and Django too, but I liked the way the American dudes played early jazz. It was just kind of more, it sounded such a great bridge to get from the Delta blues to jazz, you know.
You ever check out a guy named Oscar Moore? He was Nat King Cole.
Nat King Cole.
God.
I learned, you know, all that Nat King Cole trio stuff. I used to learn all those arrangements and solos in college. And another guy that they did a similar trio was Art Tatum trio, Tiny Grimes.
Yeah, man.
You know, I was trying to learn Tiny Grimes' solos, and then I didn't know that he played a tenor guitar.
Yeah.
So he was playing in fifths.
Four strings, and it was, dude.
Four string in fifths is such a complete, it just blows your mind. You know?
Yeah, that Oscar Moore, I watch him on some YouTube video. He's just, just amazing.
First of all, what a tone.
Oh.
That tone, just beautiful. And yeah, man, I love...
He's
that,
flying all over the neck, and that's so melodic and so and so what was nice about him is, you know, he, as Nat King Cole's guitar player, you know, he couldn't be the main guy. So he's doing all this wild shit while being, you know, subdued at the same time.
That's right.
Which was really not easy, you know?
Absolutely. I love that stuff.
Let's talk about Desert Island Discs, Doug, in no particular.
Amazing Grace by Aretha Franklin.
Great song.
The record.
Yeah.
The record is Cornell Dupree, Bernard Purdy, Chuck Rainey. Yeah, man. That's the record.
Chuck Rainey's awesome. What about number two and three? In no particular order, and just for today.
The complete Robert Johnson and Songs in the Key of Life.
Awesome. A lot of people pick Songs in the Key of Life.
Okay, I'll change it then.
No, I'm just... No. You're funny. You're like, God, I don't want to be like other people. I feel you on that one, man. No, but a lot of people love...
Notice I picked three double albums. So yeah. I get six.
Dude, you could pick a box set, man. This is a very, very easygoing standards here, man. This is about openness, not restriction. Man, I'm getting close to time. I want to figure some good questions to ask you. What's the most important thing you've learned about yourself over this journey? Because you certainly are a pretty introspective guy, and you're really into growing.
That every human person would benefit from therapy. My wife and I talk about it all the time. It's like whenever we run up into problems with other people, we're just like, are they in therapy? No. Well, there you go.
That's funny.
And it really just comes down to, and this is why I love my marriage so much, is that we don't take days off. There's no, I'm just taking a day off from my marriage today. And I don't mean that in like, you know, going and like, you know, banging some stripper on the road.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm saying like every day you have to feed your marriage. You have to feed your relationship. You have to feed yourself. You have to feed your, you know, whatever it is. So every day I try to be a little bit better than I was before. That gets me. It's like I want to be a better husband. I want to be a better father. That's why I practice guitar. That's why I read. That's why it's always about a journey of doing stuff, because I'm never going to get there. None of us are ever going to get anywhere. Right. Because if you showed me right now, if someone took, even 20 years ago when I moved to New York and had no money, they said, okay, well, in 20 years, you're going to have just the coolest 13-year-old kid. You're going to have a 3-bedroom, 2-bath apartment in a doorman building, a kitchen full of food, a smoking hot wife, a room full of guitars, and some dude is going to be talking to you about your life. Like, I would look at that and be like, holy shit, I will have made it. Now, where I'm at right now, I don't feel like I made anything. I feel like I've got all this other stuff that I got to be doing. But you have to stay on that. On that mentality, you can't ever just kind of, because I think I did learn earlier that if you rest on your laurels and you think that you've arrived, then you'll find that you've arrived nowhere.
Yeah, man, you can't take your foot off the gas. You can take it off for a little bit and back off, but you got to keep your foot on that pedal most of the time.
Yeah,
that's just the way it works. Happiest moment or time in your life. You know, one thing about, I just want to say one thing about that with your marriage. Some guy told me a long, long time ago, and I really held to this. I valued this advice because I thought it made a lot of sense. He said, your marriage is like your business. If you stop working it, it stops working. Yeah. And I thought that was such practical, good advice. And it was, and I've tried to do that as best as I can. And so far, so good.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. I think that there's, you know, people inevitably change. I don't expect to be the same person when I'm 60. The thing is you have to, you know, checking in with your partner every day is you got to make sure that you're growing together. And if you check in and you're like, oh, you're going that way. Okay, I'll check that out. And you can just kind of, you know, my wife and I always talk about, we want to those monkeys that swing each other up to the next branch.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some days I'm throwing her up and some days
yeah,
I'm so big, but thank God she's throwing me up too.
Yeah.
You know,
now you want to be catalysts for each other for sure, man.
That's really what it's about. And it's just every day taking a moment to do that is, you know, the happiest moment in my life. I mean, I certainly have had some, I don't know, man, it's hard to, I tend not to focus on what the happiest moment was. I feel right now there's a lot of things in life that I wish were different. A lot of things I wish I could change, but you know, I've been in places in my life where I have, you know, I've been at the lowest points, you know, I was so moved and hurt by all of these recent suicides that we've seen, you know, but Anthony Bourdain, I just loved his books and loved his TV shows. And to find, you look at someone like that and you see, wow, what a great life he's got and a daughter and best career. And yet somehow he found the darkness and the darkness won, you know? And I've been in that place. I've been at the verge of taking my own life and I got right up to the edge of it. And I've been in those lows and I'm really, I guess for me, where I'm at now is, you know, I know that if I ever feel that again, I know what to do to prevent going to the darkest place. But I just feel like I have to remain positive and just full of gratitude in this moment, you know, because that's the only one that really matters. I can look back at any number of great things that have happened. My son being born, you know, a million and one amazing moments that I've had with Morgan. And, you know, we've got two great little dogs, you know, lots of things in the past. But right here, right now, I live in such great abundance that, you know, I try to stay in that spot and I fail all the time. I get jealous of what other people have. I get frustrated with the situation that we face in our society right now. I get frustrated with my wife. I get mad at my dogs. I'm tired of my cat vomiting, but my life is amazing.
Yeah.
So happiest moment is right now.
Good, man. I feel you on that for sure. Hey, what's your favorite New York City food?
Ooh, this is tough because I am now 5 months into being a vegan.
Oh, wow. That's like a full-time job, isn't it?
I'm cool with it. I like it. But, you know, my favorite New York food traditionally has been just like, God, that is, you really put me on the spot with that one. That's a tough one because I love and always have loved. I'll stick with this one because in my leanest times, when I had no money whatsoever, I would be down in the Village quite a bit, you know, and I could always go to Mamoun's Falafel.
There you go.
And back in the day, it was like, I think, $2.50 or $2.75 or something. And that was a big, giant falafel sandwich with vegetables and bread. So it really stuck with you for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that's it, Mamoun's Falafel.
Well, I used to eat the lamb too, but yeah, the falafel, always a favorite.
There you go. Touché. Two more questions, man. What are you looking forward to in the future, either musically or personally?
I am looking forward to the surprises. When I watched as a 13-year-old kid, I saw Bring on the Night, a documentary about Sting. Mm-hmm. It was about the formation of his first solo band after he left the Police. Or as we said in Memphis, the Police.
The Police.
Man, you heard that dang old new record by the Police? Man, yeah. that's red dang old Roxanne, man. I tell you, I like it. So
that's awesome, dude.
Sting was talking about it in this documentary. He said he was going to be an English professor. And he said, so I saw it. I would get my master's, and then I would go on to become a professor. And then a few years down the road, I'd become a headmaster. And there I looked, and there was my life all planned out. I don't have any idea what my life will look at specifically. I mean, I'm going to be, you know, I'm fully going to be married to this wonderful woman. She has totally turned me into the world's sappiest dog person of all time. So I'm going to have dogs, and I'm going to play music as long as I got hands. Or if I don't have hands, I'll sing or something. But like, I'll be doing that. But I could have never predicted that this is where I would end up doing these kinds of things. But I've been doing it long enough that, you know, until I got this job at Juilliard, I went for like 21 years without having a direct deposit. You know, so like, I don't know what the future holds, but I know if I focus on what I'm supposed to be doing, I've just learned to trust the process of like, man, doors open. Gigs will come, gigs will go, money will come, money will go, good times, bad times, good presidents, bad presidents, you know, good food, bad food, veganism, maybe there'll be a steak in my future. I don't know.
There you go, man. I have a feeling there will be.
But I'm just like, I'm looking forward to being pleasantly surprised.
That's great, man. I like that answer a lot. I'm kind of like that. I don't like planning too much, you know. And it's that old thing. You want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, you know.
Tell him your plans. That's right.
And last question, Doug, and I really appreciate your time. It's been real good talking with you. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this change has been deliberate and intentional, and how much has just been a natural part of aging?
Well, I think that over the last 10 years, I've gone through a really significant amount of changes, you know. I've always struggled with just things dating back from my childhood. I've always had some, you know, insecurities about myself. And, you know, for most of my life, I was incredibly overweight. You know, I was almost 400 pounds at one point in my life.
Wow, man. Props to you.
So I think that over the last 10 years or so, I've been able to solve some of my physical issues, I think, and become a healthier human.
That's great.
But also just how that's affected my personality is it's made me realize that none of that is related to what you do with your body. You know, it does affect you. It affects the way other people see you. I definitely don't like the way that people are towards fat people. They think less of you. They treat you shitty. If you're thinner, you get treated differently. I felt that being able to kind of change some things about my physical life and becoming healthier and being more cognizant of those things has helped me want to match that pace personally. So I think that's why I've always stayed in therapy and I've learned to, you know, in my career, especially the last 10 years, kind of something that I alluded to before, you know, I used to get so sad and really just disappointed that like, I wasn't like the, the world's most talked about jazz guitarist that everyone wanted to be like, and you know, that like Pat Metheny would have, you know, people over to his house and hang out with them, you know, like all the young kids, oh, you have to go to Pat's house and hang out. You know, I used to feel bad about those things. And now I'm like, I feel good about who I am. It's like, I'm not supposed to be them.
Yeah.
If you like me as a person, or if you like me as a player, great. But if you don't, I'm really cool with it. I'm okay. I'm okay with, like, there's some people that just don't like me. I'm not for everybody. You know, I'm an acquired taste, I think. I'm not like,
you know? I like that.
And I think with music too, it's like, there's just, I do this thing that I do, and I've arrived at where I've arrived because of my choices. And yeah, there's a lot of things I can't do. There's a lot of things I don't sound good at. And I'm fine with it, because there's someone else out there that's meant to do that. And I think that being okay with it, I could have never been able to teach. These kids at Juilliard are so blazing on their instruments. They just play their asses off. They're so talented. That would have made me really insecure as a younger person.
Interesting, yeah.
A lot of them can do shit I can't do. You know, I can't play giant steps at 400 in 16th notes, you know?
Yeah.
Great. When they do it, I'm like, great. Now what? You know, but I'm confident enough to be like, well, they some of them don't like me. Some of them think I'm full of shit. I'm fine.
Yeah.
You know, I've learned to just be okay with not always being liked and loved. And I've learned that if you focus on the people that you love, make their lives count, you're going to reach some people. You know, I've got a couple of students who want to hear what I have to offer, and others who don't. So I'm there for the ones who do.
Right.
And it's,
man.
In my career, in my personal life, that's all I can be, is just be the best version of what I'm supposed to be. And hopefully that'll reach someone.
Awesome, man. Well said. And I'm happy for you that you're there right now.
Thanks, brother.
Hey, listen, let me tell people where they could find you and dig your music and support you and come see you on the road. It's Doug Womble, WAMBLE. And on Instagram, you can find him at Doug Womble. On Facebook, it's Doug Womble Music. And he's going out on tour. You got a European tour with your wife, Morgan James, correct?
Yeah.
And that's morganjamesonline.com. And why don't you talk about the blue meets white stuff you'll be doing?
Yeah, we on Morgan James's YouTube channel, we do a lot of full album covers. We've done Jeff Buckley and D'Angelo and all sorts of cool stuff. And we are going to be celebrating two albums this year. One is it's Joni Mitchell's 75th birthday, and it's the 50th anniversary of the White Album by the Beatles. So we're going to be doing a tour. It's kind of a new experience. It's going to be an acoustic tour. I'm going to be playing that Mule Resophonic a lot. And we're going to go out to all sorts of dates in Europe and then next year in the U.S. playing Blue Meets White. So we're going to play Joni Mitchell's Blue and selections from the Beatles' White Album. We'll throw in a couple of our new original songs and some other stuff for you. And you can find all of Morgan's tour dates on her website. And yeah, it should be fun.
Come out and see Doug and Morgan James. Check him out again at Morgan James Online, and tell Doug that you heard him on the show and you enjoyed his interview, and support these guys' music. They're warriors, and they're working hard. And thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming on the show, man. And thanks for being yourself and telling us some cool stories.
And
if you see Courtney Love, tell her to fucking come on my show.
Yes!
That would be, I could ask like two questions and shut up, and then just, it'd be great.
that woman has some stories, let me tell you.
Yeah, just a few. Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Doug Womble for spending time with us. Please check Doug out online. It's Doug Womble, DOUGWAMBLE. I really appreciate it. And make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get our newsletter on our list right now. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.